Thank you all for coming. I won't say that we've saved the best for last, but we have saved the last for last. As our Boston, or what we call Massachusetts Bay Colony, began in 1630, at least that's when the ships landed. As others have done, I want to give us a background, and the background I'm going to give sort of tags on to more or less where Pastor Bringy left off. As modern Americans, we like our dates and we like our geography, so we'll scratch that itch first before we talk about some other things. In 1625 in England, Charles I became king. He was the son of James I of the King James Bible fame. Charles I was a strong believer in the divine right of kings, so he's already at odds with Parliament in England. He's also a very strong supporter of high church Anglicanism, and then he goes and marries a French Catholic by the name of Henrietta Maria, and actually Maryland is named after her, Henrietta Maria, and her Catholicism, she was so staunchly Catholic, she did not attend her husband's coronation because it was a Protestant service, okay? So that just tells you where she comes from. So the Puritans in England are detecting that things are not looking up for us. We're expecting things to go south. And then actually by 1629, Charles I dissolves Parliament. So in 1630, what begins is called the Great Migration. If you look at, you can do Wikipedia, the Great Migration, you'll be able to read about it. Basically, the Puritans began becoming pilgrims without really admitting it. As they're leaving England, as they see things deteriorating in the home country. Now, the Great Migration is not just what went to Massachusetts Bay Colony. The estimate is about 80,000 persons left over the course of 10 to 12 years. So the official end date, we could call 1642. And about 20,000 each went to the West Indies, went to Netherlands, went to Ireland, and went to New England. Now, we're focusing on, obviously, the group that's going to New England, which is called the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And basically 700 to 1,000, roughly, we're not sure the exact numbers, migrate to New England as part of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Now, I'm skipping some history of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the interest of time. Some of those details are not important. You can look it up yourself if you're interested. By about 1640, the improving conditions in England, the Great Migration begins winding down. In fact, from the Massachusetts Bay Colony, people actually start returning to support efforts in England. One historian estimated a third of the pastors left Massachusetts Bay Colony and went back to England in the 1640, 1642 timeframe to be a part of what was going on in England as more and more people are standing up to King Charles I. And there wasn't quite that many of the population, maybe 10%. There's various estimates. Nobody's really sure. But anyway, it's in 1642, the English Civil War actually started. It lasted till 1651. And then you may have heard Charles I was executed in 1649, which opened the door for Cromwell, who became Lord Protector in 1653. So that's your big picture background. Remembering 1630 is sort of our key date where we start. With regard to Massachusetts Bay Colony, so what's known as the Winthrop Fleet, that would give you a hint that maybe Winthrop was the first governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, was 11 ships. Like, compare that to Plymouth. It might be helpful to think of Massachusetts Bay as basically the Plymouth Colony, the Mayflower times 10. And then you're in the ballpark there. So we have 11 ships with about 700 to 1,000 people. And also they came over the summer. Not all at once. There was, I don't remember exactly how many different groups of ships, but in the whole, there was 11 ships that arrived over the course of the summer. I think there was two arrived about 3 weeks apart. So they did fairly well physically. They had, again, a lot more people. And something to think about, and Pastor Bringy talked about how the pilgrims were a mixed multitude, because there was basically an unbelieving group called the Merchant Adventurers, which helped fund the pilgrims going over to Plymouth. But that's not the case with regard to the Puritans. There was an explicitly Christian or Puritan company, the Massachusetts Bay Company, and basically this was Puritans coming over. That does not mean there were no unbelievers or no non-Puritans in the group, but certainly a much lower percentage than what we find in Plymouth. As far as some of the major events that you may have heard of that are worth discussing, and we could debate whether these were successes or failures, maybe somewhat of a combination. We have what's called the separatist controversy. You may have heard of Roger Williams, who basically is considered the founder of Rhode Island, certainly of the Providence area of Rhode Island. He came in 1631 to Plymouth as a Puritan, actually as a pastor, but found that, he came to Boston as a pastor, but he found that Boston was not quite pure enough for him. He was overemphasizing or over-requiring of others a doctrinal purity that would, where eventually Roger Williams got to the point where he thought only he and his wife was worthy to take communion with. He started excluding more and more groups who weren't quite pure enough in his eyes. And so he went to Plymouth. They weren't good enough. So he returns to Boston in 1633, continues to stir up controversy. By 1636, he was banished, although he had already escaped, so they couldn't officially have the banishment ceremony, as it were. But he went and founded Providence Plantation. And then apparently somewhere along the line, the pendulum swung completely to the other side, where he basically said, as long as you're worshiping according to your conscience, you can do what you want to do. And so Rhode Island became known as kind of a, if you don't fit anywhere else, Rhode Island will take you, which is quite a contrast from where Roger Williams is heading in the first place. So that was an interesting difficulty, in fact, that the Boston had to deal with. And I do want to be careful. When I say Boston, Massachusetts Bay Colony was not limited to Boston. There were various towns, and the number of towns and the boundary of that colony increased over time as more and more people came, remembering that starting with 1,000 and within 10 years, you're at 20,000 besides your local births and that way of adding to your population. Having said that, John Winthrop and Roger Williams maintained a friendly correspondence throughout their time. John Winthrop apparently saw some strength in Roger Williams. And Roger Williams helped notify the Bostonians, the Massachusetts Bay Colony of some Indian issues as well. So they still worked alongside each other, recognizing that they were not compatible. They were oil and water, and we're going to stay separate, and keep our distance. Another big controversy that had to be dealt with was the Antinomian controversy. You may have heard the name Anne Hutchinson. The controversy there, Anne Hutchinson was a very intelligent, strong-willed woman, also a midwife. So she got around. She knew probably everybody. And she took it upon herself to explain to the women, you think of a modern-day Titus II group, they would discuss the sermons afterward. And that was normal. People didn't make a big deal out of it until you start teaching error. And basically where Anne ended up in her doctrine was that sanctification does not necessarily result from justification. In other words, you can be saved and there's no external evidence of that salvation. I don't know how you come up with that by opening scripture, but Anne came up with that. And something else that Anne did was she determined that because of the Holy Spirit indwelling in her, she could determine who was saved. And one of the things she did is she basically said all the local pastors were not saved, except the two who happened to be more favorable to her. So that's something, another controversy that had to be dealt with. And so by 1637, she was banished by the civil authorities. And then the next year, 1638, she was excommunicated by the church. She also ended up in Rhode Island, although she moved from Rhode Island and Dot actually lived a relatively short life, was killed in an Indian attack. I think only her 9-year-old daughter survived that. and her husband had already passed away. Something else of major importance, this we would consider this a success or a positive. In 1641, the colony produced what we might call the first modern, quote-unquote, Bill of Rights, which is called the Massachusetts Body of Liberties. And that was actually a major source of our constitutional Bill of Rights. When the founders of our nation writing the Constitution, that was one of their sources they looked to. Now, the Massachusetts Body of Liberties is much longer than our Bill of Rights. They were trying to distill what needs to be put in a national government versus the more detailed administration of an individual colony. But certainly an important work there. And I'm going to skip ahead 50 years, that by the year 1691, the Plymouth colony was officially absorbed into the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And that was basically the king. This was not Charles I, because he was dead. We're getting into Charles II and his those who came after him. But basically, the paperwork and the charters had to be redone because there was confusion. I mean, Plymouth existed actually not under the charter that was originally given because they weren't in Virginia, which is where their charter was in effect. So all these issues were finally straightened out in 1691, at which point the Massachusetts Bay Colony absorbed Plymouth. That's some of our big picture dates, and I mentioned some of the controversy, some of the larger difficulties that we might have heard of. But now I want to mention and talk a little bit about John Winthrop. John Winthrop was governor, but he was not a pastor. He was a layman. He was trained in law. He actually practiced as a judge in England. And so that might help you give a little bit of a sense of the fact that he had experience in dealing with people in conflict as part of his previous job in England. He was the one who preached. You might have heard the sermon, which is commonly called City on a Hill. You may have heard that phrase. That comes from John Winthrop. Although the title of that sermon is A Model of Christian Charity, which he delivered to those who were on the ship he was on, the Arbella, or some people spell it Arabella, on the way over to the New World. He was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and he was elected 12 times. They had yearly elections just like the Plymouth Colony did. So in that sense, the civil leaders were kept on a somewhat short leash, because if you made enough people mad, they were going to vote you out within a year. But he was elected 12 times in the 17-ish years between 1631 and 1648. It's interesting when you read the history that he would make an unpopular decision and he would be out for maybe a year or two. And then the people saw his wisdom and he was well respected enough, even though sometimes a good man has to make an unpopular decision. And so they would often brought him back. And it might be fair to say that there would not have been a Massachusetts Bay Colony without John Winthrop. It really bears the stamp of his personality and his wisdom, perhaps to the extent we might say the same about Plymouth Colony and William Bradford. We might characterize John Winthrop as, and this might sound self-contradictory, as flexibly authoritarian. John Winthrop, we're a very strongly egalitarian culture. We tell all the young kids, you can be president if you want to be. Well, just because you want to be doesn't mean you should be or that you have the talent to. John Winthrop clearly recognized that there were people with abilities that made them suitable to lead, and there were other people who just didn't belong in leadership positions. And that was not an uncommon view back then. That was, I think, the more realistic, the more biblical, and a view that was held in those times. And so, in that sense, he was authoritarian. He recognized he's in charge, he's responsible, and he is going to rule as he sees fit. And the reason I use the word flexibly is, first of all, he strongly preferred to use persuasion. He was not, okay, this is how it's going to be. He would try to take the people with who he disagreed and say, look, here's what I'm thinking. Here's why we should be going the way I think we should be going. Now, when when push came to shove, if he had to put his fist down on the podium, he would do that. But that was not his first recourse. He did not have an autocratic personality. Recognizing also he would only last a year anyway, right? But keeping that in mind, perhaps the best way to say it is that there's many instances in his history of ruling where he even deliberately tried not to he tried to minimize the amount of laws actually put in writing, because he was fearful that written laws would unnecessarily limit what the government officials could do in order to recognize the situation. And part of our problem nowadays is we try to make law that covers every conceivable situation, which makes the law so big you have no idea what it's saying, and you can't possibly be familiar with all of it. But that at least gives us a little bit of a picture of who John Winthrop was. I'm going to read a little bit of the end of his sermon, A Model of Christian Charity, as we close this talk. But I also want to talk about some important principles and issues related to the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Like Plymouth, this was mostly middle-class families. Now, Plymouth was middle class that had been kind of shaved down to lower class. They were middle class socially, but their economic difficulty in the Netherlands made them a bit poorer. That was not the case in Plymouth. In fact, John Winthrop had a sizable sum of money to his name, and he actually helped fund a great deal of the purchases that had to be made by the colony. He provided gunpowder, he bought food, he bought a whole bunch of different things. He took his personal interest in the colony very seriously. Now, the advantage, the wisdom there of having almost all families is that you have social stability, you have reproduction, you have a future if you have families involved in an effort like this. Where it's just men, you either quickly rectify the situation or it's not going to last, as we saw in talking about Jamestown. There is, we've already talked about the population, about 20. Somebody mentioned, one historian thought that the population was about 22,500 by 1650, remembering that they lost population after 1640, 1642, because people were heading back. In a certain sense, the Puritans came to England by necessity. They wanted to survive the persecution that they saw coming. And so many of them wanted to go back. It was a minority. And by this time, after you live someplace 10 to 15 years, it may actually grow on you. And probably that's what kept a lot of the majority of those in the colony there. There were certainly some young men who came over seeking work and seeking to make their way in life. But also, as they came over, there was no gentry class. Now, we're not, maybe we could argue that we do have a gentry class in a different sense, but certainly in England there was the ruling class, and you weren't considered a ruler unless you were born into that ruling class. That expectation was not brought over with the Puritans. Another thing that's of interest is even though they were Presbyterian in doctrine, they were congregational in government. So think of a Presbyterian church that's independent of the other Presbyterian churches. Now, that actually causes some problems with regard to trying to maintain unity, because if each church is considered it's more or less autonomous self, if you get a bad pastor in there who starts teaching these really weird things that then causes all sorts of discord and dissension within the broader community, within the church structure, there's not much you can do about that. You don't have higher church courts that can bring that pastor under discipline or perhaps even remove him from the pulpit. And that's where the civil authority actually had to step in oftentimes and resolve these issues. And in a sense, we might even say that there was a discontinuity, there's a disconnect in the mind of those who came to Massachusetts Bay Colony, is in that they had a strong central government, recognizing that this is not national, this is over a colony, smaller than most of the cities we're familiar with. And yet, the churches were all independent. There was no hierarchy, really, so to speak, at all with among the churches. And this was actually in contrast to the Puritan movement in England, which was largely Presbyterian in government. So we do see a distinction there between what happened in New England with the Puritans and in the old country, England. But they came over truly seeking to create a Christian commonwealth. Much like the Pilgrims, although in the case of Boston, they actually started off with a doctrinally pure group. They were all, basically, they were all Puritans. Again, not 100%, but certainly a much higher percentage than what we see in Plymouth. Their civil laws were based on God's law. If you look at the, you remember I mentioned the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, you will see a lot of Old Testament laws along with Old Testament sanctions attached to those. And now, having said that, the historical records indicate that what was written as the punishments were not very often enforced. Usually you would very often find a lesser enforcement. So what we read about the law, if you just looked at the law as written, taking 1641, the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, if you took that literally and thought that happened in every case, you would think you were living in a very harsh judicial system. And that's not how it was actually carried out. Remember how I even said that Jonathan Winthrop was flexibly authoritarian. He wanted to take what was going on in a particular situation into account in making his judgments. He didn't want to be constrained by a written law that required him to do certain things that wouldn't make sense. He really wanted to practice judicial discernment and discretion. But having said that, you will plainly see God's law in the written laws of the colony from that era. Some of the tensions that they had to deal with. There was this tension between authority and liberty, between society and individual. If you study philosophy, you'll hear that described as the problem of the one and the many. What's the balance between an individual's rights of conscience and to be actually an individual person that they are, and their responsibilities and duties to the broader community? Now, their view was pretty much the opposite of what our current culture has. Our current culture is radically autonomous. Don't you dare tell me what I can do because it's all about me. That was really unknown by the vast majority of people who lived back then. But they did have to deal with this tension. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they did tend to go more toward the authority or more toward the responsibility to society. Everybody was expected to do their part and to take care of others. In fact, Winthrop's sermon, A Model of Christian Charity, was an exhortation on we need to take care of each other. That if you have more and your neighbor has less, if he has the ability or perceived ability to pay you back, you loan it to him and you don't charge him a huge amount of interest. If he can't pay you back, then you give it to him. This is what Christ has called us to do as a body of believers. There was always a tension between being in the world and being not of the world. Like Roger Williams, if you're seeking perfect purity, you're going to end up with a church of one, which is not a church, right? So as Christians, we are sinners living with other sinners and yet all called to sanctification according to a single standard, of which we don't always agree what that standard means. And so we have to live with a realism about that fact. And so that's something that Winthrop and the other leaders of the community had to deal with, that we are seeking to be an example to the world. We are seeking to establish a Christian commonwealth, but we're not all going to walk in lockstep. So that was something that had to be dealt with. And somewhat related, there's always this tension between religious unity and freedom of conscience. Now, in our view, we would say that they leaned far more toward having religious unity. The issue with Anne Bradstreet, remembering the civil authority banished her for her religious teaching, but also for the civil result of that religious teaching. Hutchinson, sorry. What did I say? Yeah, you know, I'm glad you corrected me on that, because her poetry was way better than William Bradford's, but that's another story. I'll just briefly, thanks for correcting me, and I'll mention real briefly. Ann Bradstreet was came over in the early group to the Massachusetts Bay Colony. She wrote poetry kind of as a hobby in her free time, and then her brother-in-law, I think it was her brother-in-law, took her works to England and have them published without her permission. And she became really famous, and you can read about her, and you can read her poetry today. And like I said, better than William Bradford. But anyway, there's this tension between religious unity and freedom of conscience. Again, recognizing that individuals are called to do what they are called to do before God. But in this colony, we do have a responsibility to be of one mind, recognizing not perfectly, there's wiggle room there. And so if you depart too much from what we are here and what we are about doctrinally, you will be told to leave, or asked to leave first, or amend your ways so that you would fit into what our vision is. Now, having said that, you know, we've talked a little bit about the failures. And if I had to mention one failure, and this gets back to what Mr. Huffman said, that whereas the first generation has a zeal for the things of the Lord, is taking risk and putting themselves in hardship, and hardship might be different depending on the situation, to recover godliness in family, to recover godliness in church, to recover godliness even in the government, and individually, what does it really mean to be sanctified, or are we just going to go to heaven and that's all we care about? That the second generation often does not appreciate that and does not carry on that zealousy. Now, Harvard was founded in the Massachusetts, basically in Boston, in order to train ministers, Puritan ministers, for the gospel. And it was actually founded, the funds to start Harvard was a bequest of a Puritan pastor, his name was Harvard, if you can believe that, who died wishing there to be a training for Puritan pastors to be established. Well, even basically by the end of the 1700s, by the time of the, I mean, and it's not like a switch was thrown and all of a sudden we flipped from one extreme to the other, but basically by the late 1700s, Harvard was already going Unitarian in that direction. And I think it was 1805, their first Unitarian professor was actually appointed to be a professor at Harvard University. And so if anything that would indicate the failure, and not the fault of the first generation, but there were failures in succeeding generations in the Massachusetts Bay Area to carry on the faith and to push back against the Unitarian threat. So I'm going to end with probably correcting a historical misunderstanding about the phrase, the city on a hill. When Winthrop uses the phrase, the city on the hill, he's not saying, and I'm not certainly he would agree with this, that we are setting an example for others. But his point in saying we're a city on a hill is that if we fail, we are going to drag God's name through the mud. So let me quote here. Now, the only way to avoid this shipwreck, and when he says the shipwreck, he's referring to earlier, where he says God has commissioned us to a holy work as we go to the new world. God has commissioned us, and when God commissions a people, he holds them to a high standard. The only way to avoid this shipwreck, meaning failing in what God has called us to do, and to provide for our posterity, is to follow the counsel of Micah, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. For this end, we must be knit together in this work as one man. You see, the wisdom of Winthrop is that he knew if we're a bunch of radical individuals, this is going to fall apart really quick. We have to be in agreement about what we're about, and we have to help each other and exhort each other in going about it. I'll continue. We must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work that we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. Winthrop knew they were doing something that the world could watch, and he did not want the Puritans, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, to disappoint God. And that's why he actually used that phrase, city on a hill. And he ends by quoting from Deuteronomy 30, if our hearts shall turn away so that we will not obey, but shall be seduced and worship other gods, worship our pleasure, worship our prophets, and serve them, it is propounded unto us this day, we shall surely perish out of the good land whither we pass over this vast sea to possess it. That's not a quote from Deuteronomy 30. But then he quotes Deuteronomy 30. Therefore, let us choose life that we and our seed may live. By obeying his voice and cleaving to him, for he is our life and our prosperity. See, choosing life is choosing to obey God. Winthrop knew that. The Massachusetts Bay Colony folks knew that. And that's what they sought to do. At least in that first couple of generations, they did a pretty good job. But over time, we see that the succeeding generations frittered away what they were given by their forefathers. Thank you.